Thank you, David. So it's great to be here, especially since this subject developed with great help from KITP and its programs. So it's really a subject that is at an early stage, although there are several reviews already of initial steps in this direction, including one with my former student in law, Leah McAllister. And all of these, though, are even a little bit out of date. So I'll try and explain that as we go. So the plan of the talk is to begin with an overview of inflation, its motivations, and its observable consequences as a general framework. And then I'll discuss a theoretical issue, which is one of the main themes of this talk. Inflationary model building really requires what we call a UV completion. It's sensitive to a few quantum gravity effects in a precise sense. And string theory is a well-known candidate for quantum gravity, so we'll work in that framework. Then I'll move to, with this motivation, mechanisms for inflation within string theory. And there are by now roughly three or four classes that have really been constructed from the so-called top-down point of view, which surprisingly have led each of them to some observational consequences, and so I'll cover that. But the basic overall overarching theme of this talk is that inflation is both UV sensitive, which is a theoretical issue, and it's accessible to upcoming observations that will, while limited, really help pin down, distinguish among different classes of models. So it's a good time for this field. So let me start with a review of inflation. So there's strong evidence for it in the early universe as well as in the late universe. And this was originally realized by Guth, Linde, Albrecht, and Steinhardt. And one of the early motivations was this puzzle that we also heard about in yesterday's colloquium, that if you look in two diametrically opposite directions in the sky, you see the same temperature in the cosmic microwave background radiation, which emanates from the time of recombination. So here we're looking at it in two different directions. And if you extrapolate back naively the decelerating expansion that we see at later times in the universe, you reach something of a puzzle, because as you extrapolate that back all the way, say, to the Planck density, where quantum gravity effects become definitely important, there's not time in between that epoch and the epoch of recombination for these different regions that we're seeing to have come to equilibrium by some natural thermodynamic process. From this picture, from the point of view of this picture, it would have had to be true that some mysterious quantum gravity mechanism just enforced that there was the same temperature in these two directions. That's an open possibility, but it's hard to establish and certainly hasn't been established in any theory of quantum gravity that we know. Instead, there's a beautiful solution of this problem within the framework of quantum field theory and general relativity, where you basically push the problem back in time, meaning you postulate an early period of accelerated expansion instead of extrapolating back this decelerating expansion all the way to the Planck era. And you can see just from this figure, what I'm drawing again is a scale factor as a function of time. And now I've taken into account this postulate of acceleration. So fixing the expansion today, that means it was expanding more slowly in the past. The universe is older, and it had time to have equilibrated since this epoch of high-scale physics. So the equations that we use to describe this are those of general relativity, curvature in the form of the time expansion of the scale factor of the universe, Hubble squared, is sourced by the stress energy, the hard cosmological term, curvature terms, and matter density terms. And you get accelerated expansion if you look at this simple equation, if you postulate a nearly constant term lambda here on the right-hand side of the equation. So that this equation is solved by an exponential expansion. And that explains this puzzle and also explains why we don't see a lot of relics of high-scale physics in general, like monopoles that might come from grand unification and so on. Now, inflation solved these macroscopic problems in a beautiful way, but equally importantly, it led to a new effect, a very simple mechanism for the origin of structure in the universe, which was tested 20 years later in a way that wasn't predicted originally to be possible. So this is the story of fluctuation in the cosmic microwave background. And let's build up to this a little bit slowly. So first of all, we know that we don't have a rapid accelerating expansion in the present era. so this inflationary epoch has to end, and that term that I wrote down here better not stay around forever. And the simplest way to model that is to take it to be the potential energy depending on the value of some scalar field phi, the so-called inflaton, so that at early times there can be a large potential energy, but then later the field rolls down and loses that potential energy. And one can show by solving the coupled Einstein equations that I reviewed earlier with the scalar field equation of motion itself, indicated here, and see that this combined system leads to accelerated expansion as long as the potential energy of the inflaton phi dominates over its kinetic energy. There are many different ways to arrange that. You need this process to last for a sufficiently long time. You need to grow the universe by 60 E foldings in scale factor for a Hubble of about 10 to the 14 GeV. And what does that have to do with the CMB? Well, this scalar field has its own quantum mechanical fluctuations. Those turn out to give a seed for structure in a nice, simple way. So the basic idea is to start with our scalar field, which is in this background solution, rolling down its potential energy, and consider then its quantum fluctuations, delta phi, which solve a simple equation of motion in this background. At short distances, they just look like ordinary fluctuations in Minkowski space, in just flat space-time. But then, as the universe expands, the wavelengths of the modes expand until they exceed the Hubble horizon. They become larger than the inverse Hubble scale in this cosmology. So they freeze out at that point, and their amplitude can be determined very simply from a quantum mechanics calculation of essentially their zero point energy. So consider some region of space that is of size L, or wavelength L in the scalar field. And in that finite system, the problem of understanding these fluctuations boils down to quantum mechanics. The action for the variable x related to this delta phi is given here as just x dot squared plus stuff. This is a normal quantum mechanics problem with a conjugate momentum that scales like delta x over L for this wavelength L type mode. And the uncertainty principle, where the zero point energy comes in, says delta x delta p is at least 1 in units where h bar is 1. So translate that into a minimal excursion of the field in this quantum mechanical system. And you can translate that into an amplitude that's basically its physical momentum, its fiducial momentum divided by the scale factor A of the universe. And so when that stretches out to size Hubble, that is, if the wavelength of this mode stretches out to size Hubble inverse, then the amplitude of this mode you can read off as just Hubble. And you know that agrees with a more sophisticated calculation of the solution of this equation of motion for the modes. So it's a beautiful thing. These basic zero point energy fluctuations of the inflaton, which we added for a different reason to end inflation, are born in this way. And then later when inflation does end, they come back inside the horizon because the horizon stops, the modes stop exponentially expanding. And it's known how to then translate them into seeds of the structure that we see. And this is a large industry in cosmology. So we can characterize their effects through their power spectrum, basically their two-point correlation function, properly written. This is the curvature two-point correlation function, basically. And its normalization is known from the COBE satellite to be about 10 to the minus 10. This is the square of delta T over T. We're also interested not just in these scalar fluctuations, but in the tensor modes of the graviton itself. And a similar calculation shows that their zero point energy translates into this much power. So let me just say that again, slightly more formally. We look at the metric of our cosmological space-time, including some fluctuations, which we can shuffle either into our scalar field phi or into a scalar mode of the metric itself just by reparameterizing what we call time. we have a scalar mode and also these tensor modes that I mentioned living in a background of exponential expansion. So the basic observables in the CMB coming from this effect are the power spectrum, whose normalization I just gave you, and its tilt. It depends on the time at which this mode freezes out as it crosses the Hubble horizon, because Hubble is changing slowly, and that gives what's called a tilt to the spectrum, this index n sub s. We're interested in these tensor modes. That'll be a theme of this talk, too. The ratio of the tensor to scalar power is known as little r. And finally, you can ask, why am I just calculating the two-point function of these perturbations? There's no reason a priori just to do that, and so we also consider the higher point correlation functions of these perturbations. So that's fine. I was trying to review inflation for you, and so far you might be thinking, well, fine, everything I said can be modeled in ordinary quantum field theory and general relativity. So why did I put string theory in the title? And the reason is that although these go a long way, they don't really give a complete description. So to see this, let me review for you some notions in effective field theory, basically. Yeah, sure. I'll say more about it later, but oh yeah, very much so. I mean, they haven't been seen yet, although there's a two sigma hint of this. But they don't have to be too small. Let me hold your question, and I'll be spending a portion of the talk on that subject. And definitely ask the question again if you're not satisfied. So, okay, so so gravity is a force that whose strength grows as you increase the energy. Basically, this is G Newton, the coupling strength of gravity, goes inversely with the Planck mass, and so the dimensionless coupling is the energy over the Planck mass. So at short distances, quantum effects become very important, and any new degrees of freedom that are introduced in a consistent completion of gravity then come into play. And this affects cosmology in a number of ways. The most dramatic way it affects cosmology is really in the very, very far past, where the space that we're drawing just crunches into a singularity. That's where quantum gravity really matters, and that's where we spend a lot of our effort in string theory, too, is to try and understand the physics of these singularities. We've made some progress in recent years. In fact, I gave a colloquium at the physics department about that recently, so I won't belabor it. But it's certainly the place where quantum gravity effects matter the most. And there's much more to do to understand related issues. We don't really understand the initial conditions for inflation in any clear framework, and it's an extremely interesting question. But observationally, it's hard to access because of this fact that inflation does such a beautiful job of screening microphysics from us. In fact, that's what it was designed to do. And so let's move to later times where the observables are a little more subtle and the sensitivity to quantum gravity is more limited, but still present. So we know GR is, of course, correct at long distances, but it will get strongly coupled as this effective gravitational coupling gets to be of order one. And you expect new degrees of freedom to come in to fix it up. And with, you know, some extra particles or degrees of mass m star, if they couple generically to the light stuff that you know about, their exchange will generate terms in your effective action that correct those of general relativity that I've listed up there with coefficients that die as this mass scale of the extra degrees of freedom increases, though the Planck scale is one scale that appears in such an expansion in any theory of gravity. It's so-called UV complete. And my point is that these corrections even matter for inflation. So why is that? Well, it's basically because of this fact that you need 60 E foldings, that you need to expand the universe by so much. So probably the simplest model of inflation in quantum field theory is Linde's hyperinflation model with a potential like this where you roll down a kind of valley and then exit by rolling down a waterfall field in a different direction, say. So that's what I've drawn here. But anyway, it's a general issue in inflationary model building, how you make the potential flat enough that this Hubble cosmological term changes slowly enough that you really get something approximating exponential expansion for long enough. So we parameterize that in terms of these so-called slow roll parameters, which are basically ratios of the derivative of the potential with respect over the potential itself in Planck units. And it's UV sensitive because, let me just flip to this, because those quantities get order one contributions from terms in the effective action that are suppressed by the Planck scale that have to do with these extra degrees of freedom that would be involved in completing gravity. So this operator, you can see, you just take two derivatives with respect to phi and divide by the potential, you get one. But in order to model inflation for long enough, it turns out that these two things need to be of order the percent, 0.01 or so, to get it right. Okay, so there's a limited UV sensitivity, but it's a significant UV sensitivity. And this issue, there's a more dramatic role of a UV complete theory of gravity in a classic case of inflation known as chaotic inflation or large field inflation. These are the cases where you get a tensor signal, where you get gravity waves out of inflation for reasons that I'll summarize for you, but let me start slowly. The classic model of this, again, is due to Linde, and it's a potential where you just take what may seem to be the kind of simplest thing you'd ever write down, m squared phi squared for the potential, and you start your field rolling down it. Well, you can calculate these slow roll parameters easily enough. Taking these derivatives, you basically get powers of m Planck over phi, and so you can suppress them and inflate if phi is huge, if phi is large in Planck units. There's a clever way around this where you have many of these m squared phi squared fields when you can try and avoid such a large field range for any one of them. But basically, there's a theorem due to David Leith showing that that wasn't an accident, that every time you have, and you, if you put in the numbers, every time you have, sorry, I need to add one comment to make this clear. This is a model which also gives a high scale of inflation and gives gravity, gravitational radiation as a signal. So let me just quote the relevant theorem now in general, which is that this tensor to scalar ratio R is related to the number of E-foldings and the field range delta phi in Planck units during inflation in such a way that if you put in the numbers that are required, you find that inflation with observable tensor modes requires a so-called super Planckian BEV. So what that means is that you have to control this term in the effective action that I was writing down, this potential energy term, over multiple Planck units in field space, which means that the UV sensitivity is not just one term in your effective action, but it's a whole function that you have to control. And for that reason, it's more UV sensitive. Finally, there's a third sense in which inflation is UV sensitive, which has to do with these non-Gaussian corrections. And it turns out that if you're just systematic about what inflation is, you don't put any prejudice about the model, and just ask, how do I get accelerated expansion with a single scalar degree of freedom? You find generically there are higher derivative terms that matter that affect the solution that sometimes can help slow the field down. And in those cases, the non-Gaussianity of the power spectrum comes into play. So we'll see examples of both of these in the talk. So as we heard yesterday in Shaman's talk, modeling inflation in string theory is a laborious process. It's a pain in the neck because there are lots and lots of scalar fields that you get when you, even when you make the choices that you have to make to get going with a string theory model building program. The choices you have to make include you have to choose the dimension of the total dimension of the space. That's not given to you by string theory. You have to choose the topology of the compact dimensions that you use to four dimensions. You have to choose these generalizations of electric magnetic fluxes that you also heard about yesterday. So there are all these different discrete quantum numbers that appear in any controlled corner of model building and string theory. And the compact dimensions come with lots of degrees of freedom. They come with these scalar fields, these moduli that describe the shape and size of the compact manifold, roughly speaking. So you have to stabilize all of those, or else they'll be rolling too rapidly for inflation. So roughly speaking, what you're trying to do is stabilize all but one of them and use the last one as an inflaton and insist that it live on a very flat potential, or more generally insist that it's the dynamics give inflation over a long enough period of time. So this problem was solved in various controllable corners of string theory starting in 2001 and 2003 during our KITP workshop here on string theory. That's one of the ways in which the KITP contributed to this subject. And there has been, again, interesting model building efforts in inflation that resulted from stabilizing these scalar fields. And there's a lot more to do. But what I'm going to tell you about are two mechanisms for inflation that arise in this kind of framework. That is, they descend from basic features of string theory, with this motivation that we do need a UV completion of GR to get going, with this philosophy that a model of inflation really consists of a top-down model. It's not enough to just write down a potential. And we'll see that, serendipitously really, each of these turns out to be predictive and in fact falsifiable on the basis of either the tensor to scalar ratio or the non-Gaussian corrections to the power spectrum. So these were works with Alexander Westphal most recently, and earlier with David Tong and Lucen Ali-Shahia. So again, we have this problem we have to make all these choices. Well, the simplest way to compactify the extra dimensions would be just to put in periodic boundary conditions, make a so-called torus. Well, that turns out to be probably too simple, but the very next simplest thing is perhaps a twisted torus, or so-called nil manifold, where what you do is, as you move, so this is a three-dimensional manifold in which, as you move in one of the directions, a two-dimensional torus changes its shape in such a way that as you move from here to here, it's changed from this shape to this shape, where what I mean by these pictures is imposing periodic boundary conditions along these two vectors in the plane. Well, if you look at these two shapes, you see that it's the same space, actually. If you impose, you take this as your basis for those periodic boundary conditions, or this as your basis for those periodic boundary conditions. We parameterize this in terms of this complex number tau, which goes to tau plus one, or in general, tau plus some integer as you move in this direction. This is a curved space, which helps stabilize the moduli because it leads to some potential energy. And as we'll see, it leads to an interesting mechanism for large field inflation. So I've just drawn the same thing in a slightly different way, where again, we move in one direction and we have a torus that changes shape in such a way that when we get over here, it's the same torus and we can make a compact space by then identifying it. Well, yesterday we heard about certain inflation models which involved a brain, a D brain, in a six-dimensional compact manifold, which sat at a point, so the brain filled our 3+1 dimensions and sat at a point in the rest of the compact dimensions. But there are D brains of arbitrary dimensions, and in this context, the simplest type of D brain is called a D4 brain. It has one other direction, and we can wrap that around the circles in the manifold. So it'll be a similar idea to what we heard about yesterday, except now it's a wrapped D brain that's moving around that will be our candidate inflaton. Now, the idea here is actually quite simple, so I want to describe it slowly. Take such a four brain that's wrapped on a cycle, a circle in this torus, and as you move it, since the torus changes shape, the brain actually gets heavier. So as you move from here to here to here, this circle gets longer, and it gets heavier to wrap on that circle. So the potential energy carried by this brain increases in that direction. And as you get to the other side, where the torus has changed shape to an equivalent torus, you can make the identification in the geometry, but the brain has actually come back to a different configuration, where now it's wrapping this circle instead of this circle, and it's keeps getting heavier as you go around and around this circle. So this is a really simple geometrical phenomenon which happens all over the place in theoretical physics. It's called a monodromy. And again, it's a situation where there's some circle in which you can move, where in the presence of an additional ingredient, that ingredient doesn't come back to itself. It keeps getting heavier and heavier, roughly speaking. So by working within the same little region of field space described by this motion around the circle, we can make, in effect, an arbitrarily large field range by moving around and around. The scalar field describing the motion of our wrapped brain lives on a space that is much larger than this circle in the compact geometry. So geometrically, we've obtained a large field range. And again, this phenomenon, while I've described it in probably its simplest manifestation, is extremely general. And one of the things we're looking at is how it works in many other contexts. But anyway, let me also say that this situation with a field range that's geometrically unbounded, it contrasts with the case we heard about yesterday in a very clear way. Bauman and McAllister showed that in the case of these D3 brains, which are points, you simply cannot get a large field range. It's geometrically impossible. And so different classes of examples either do or don't provide candidates for the gravitational wave solution. Again, given that large field range corresponds to the gravitational wave solution, gravitational wave signature. All right, so this geometric point is not enough. We need to analyze our effective action all along this direction, and again, control the potential throughout this motion. Now, I won't belabor all the details for you, but we can calculate in this setup where we've stabilized the compact manifold, and we're working with this simple geometry and simple wrap brain. We know exactly what to do. We can calculate the effective action. The action of a brain is basically the area it sweeps out. And from that fact, you can derive the effective potential to a good approximation. And what you find is an interesting result. You find that in the appropriate range of field space, this mildly super Planckian regime that you need to be in to do inflation, the potential is a power law, but it's not Andre's old m squared phi squared. It's, in fact, what drops out of this setup is phi to the 2/3 times some coefficient, okay? Plus corrections that one needs to control. And another point in this setup is, which one can show, is that m squared phi squared simply would not work. It can be excluded from this class of compactifications. Now, as I keep saying, one needs to control these slow roll parameters throughout the evolution, and this is, in general, challenging and would seem to be almost impossibly difficult in a case with a super Planckian range of the field. But the theory has just presented us with a very simple mechanism where this prejudice actually fails for a simple reason. As you move in the super Planckian direction, you're moving around and around the same circle in the moduli space, the same circle in this geometry that I showed. And so the issues that you encounter don't change every little Planck unit of field space. You get to, roughly speaking, you can worry about them once and address them. And because of this monodromy effect, that problem is a lot simpler. You need more than that. You need symmetries. You need the stabilization of the compactification to respect a symmetry, a homogeneity along the direction of motion to avoid large corrections to the slow roll parameters. This is very similar to the way Andre originally thought about chaotic inflation, thinking of an approximate shift symmetry for phi. And that turned out to appear naturally in this kind of setup as well. Okay, so I just said that. And most of the paper on this subject is a discussion of these corrections and why they are small, but I won't belabor that here. And just tell you the results, that it seems to work, and it provides a model which not only realizes a gravitational wave signature, but has a sort of idiosyncratic prediction because of the shape of the potential that dropped out of the structure of the compactification. This potential that goes like phi to the 2/3 is, so what's plotted here, I should say, is the tilt of the spectrum that I discussed before, n sub s, and the tensor to the scalar ratio r. And the contours here are basically the 68%, 95% confidence level W map 5 plus everything else constraints. And you can see that basically M squared, phi squared type models sit up here. They're still possible, but getting squeezed out of the preferred window. For reference, lambda phi to the 4th, another sort of simple looking potential that you can write down, is getting basically ruled out by this data already. And the really interesting thing is that, first of all, from this top-down point of view with a relatively simple mechanism, we land on, you know, a crazy power phi to the 2/3, which leads to predictions on this plot which sit in this region. And observations that are planned and really sort of 5-year-ish, maybe 5 to 10, being more conservative, that are planned are quoted as being able to pin these quantities down to basically 0.01, which is basically, you know, some ellipse like this on this plot. So one will be able to distinguish this model from the classic M squared phi squared model and from a number of others that you could also consider. What kind of tilt do you get for the tensor modes? I'm not sure. I didn't.
Are you getting exact benefits from the rotation?
There's nothing new. Well, I mean, the power spectrum overall is red, as you can see here. Okay, I haven't thought about the tilt of the tensor modes. I've just thought about the overall amplitude, which is 0.04, which is, you know, a little bit above this level of detectability. But yeah, if we're so lucky to see such an effect, certainly we should look at everything. So I'm no expert on the observations, but let me just flash one of the sort of review plots of the challenging measurement that they plan to do to look for this. And there again, it's not just one experiment. There are whatever, 4 or 5 of these things that all anticipate being able to measure the gravity waves by basically its effect on CMB scattering against electrons during reionization and recombination to this precision of 0.01. There are large foregrounds that are challenging, but they think they can model them well enough to do this. And so again, it will be a relatively small ellipse that we'll have in that plot once those measurements are done. Now, obviously, the two things I plotted are just two numbers, and there's a limit to how much you can learn from that. And so if you take if you step too far back, you might think you can learn, you know, nothing. You can't reconstruct the top-down model building up from that. But in a given quarter of string theory, say, it's really not possible to just vary all these things arbitrarily. There are subtle effects involved, but for example, I can't take this model that I just wrote down and change that power from 2/3 in any easy way, and I can't, you know, cancel out the gravity wave signature. You can look at different constructions and get different types of signatures, but that's useful too because, you know, there are, as I said, you know, at least currently a few different classes of models, and if this data works the way they say, it'll basically eliminate 3 of the 4 that we know about and maybe all 4. And so we can really make distinctions based on this stuff, even though it's obviously underdetermined as a general rule. Now, for the rest of the time, I'd like to discuss partly for this reason that the tilt and the tensor to scalar ratio are only two numbers. I want to focus on another observable, which is the non-Gaussianity of the spectrum. And this is interesting because a priori, at least, it's really a function's worth of information. It's not just two numbers. It's a three-point function. And this is called the bispectrum by observers or data analysts. And it contains information from a theoretical point of view about the interactions of the fields that are involved in inflation. So it's very interesting from that point of view. So it's some three-point correlation function of the curvature perturbation that we discussed before, and you know, hence is sensitive to the interaction Hamiltonian of the system. It's a function's worth of information, but it's not really, so I've written it in k-space, which would be three momentum vectors, but you have to subtract out for translations, rotations, and the fact that the spectrum is approximately scale invariant, which brings it down to basically two variables. And we can, it's commonly organized in this way. And there are two special, so one of the things we subtracted out here was translation invariance, meaning that the sum of these three momentum vectors has to add to zero. So it's a triangle in momentum space. And from the field theoretic point of view, one finds two shapes that come out easily. One is this kind of squeezed shape that I've drawn here, and another is an equilateral type triangle. And so we define parameters that basically measure how strong those effects are. The details aren't too important. Now, in single field slow roll inflation, these non-Gaussian effects are negligible. You often hear people say that inflation predicts a purely Gaussian spectrum. This is wrong, but the adjectives you need are single field and slow roll. And the reason for that is very simple. It's that in that context, you have a single field with a potential energy driving inflation. And to get the potential to be flat enough, it can't have too many wiggles in it. And so the interactions among the scalars in this model have to be weak. And so you can show, working it out, that this FNL parameter, this nonlinearity parameter, is tiny, 0.01 basically, in a single field slow roll model of inflation. But it's naturally large in other contexts. So in single field slow roll, you get the field to roll slowly, and therefore Hubble to change slowly by making the potential flat. But there are other ways to get the field to roll slowly and Hubble to change slowly, which is to actually use the self-interactions of the field to slow it down. And so in any case like that, it shouldn't surprise you that out pops a more nonlinear spectrum of perturbations. And this is what we saw in DBI inflation, which had interesting but more exotic precursors in so-called K-inflation and ghost inflation. A distinct shape of the non-Gaussianity comes in multi-field models, situations where you have a second field which is lighter than the Hubble scale during inflation. And because even in a slow roll case, but with an extra field, those can be nonlinear because in this transverse direction, there's nothing stopping the field from having larger self-interactions because that's not the inflaton. So these two classes of models are known to have significant non-Gaussianities. And again, in general terms, the idea is this. To get inflation, you just need Hubble to change slowly enough. So we shouldn't really write down those slow roll parameters I discussed earlier, v prime over v and so on. We should just insist that h dot over h squared is small and so on. And if you do that, just postulating that there's a single field phi driving inflation along with gravity, you find that the potential need not be flat and interactions can be substantial, not just consistently with inflation, but as part of the mechanism for slowing down the inflaton. So it's an interesting possibility, and again, a relatively simple example of this is DBI inflation, which came a bit from left field. It came from considerations, again, of brains moving around. In this case, from the ADS-CFT correspondence, where you consider, well, or just black hole physics, really. If you consider a black brain, which is falling into a black hole horizon, from the outside, it looks like it takes forever. This is just true of the classical solution. In ADS-CFT, you have one of these gravitationally redshifted throats that we also heard about yesterday. And this similar statement is true. It takes forever for a brain to fall to the horizon of that space. And that fact that it takes forever basically means that the corresponding scalar collective coordinate is being slowed down by some effect. And the effect that's involved can be understood from the appropriate effective action, which is like that of basically a relativistic particle. So if you have a relativistic particle with position x, its effective action is given by this square root of 1 minus x dot squared, which you can see by varying it and getting the correct relativistic equations of motion. And, you know, the velocity x dot is limited to be less than 1 by, you know, basic physics of relativity, which is enforced by this action. So the same thing happens in dBi inflation, where the square root form of the kinetic terms in the action, which descends from this kind of left field ADS-CFT story, also has the effect of enforcing a speed limit on the motion of the inflaton. That's a very simple idea, even though the action looks a bit more complicated. And when it comes to classifying inflationary models, again, I think the only sort of unprejudiced thing to do is just count number of fields. So this is a single field model. And in that sense, it's equally likely as any other single field model for all we know. Anyway, so this is the idea, and it's a case where the interactions slow down the field for a simple reason, and where, as a result of that, the perturbations are more nonlinear than they would be in slow roll inflation. Starting from the square root action, that can be seen not just via those words, which are part of the intuition, but from the fact that as you perturb the inflaton phi, perturb the action by varying with respect to the inflaton phi, you pull down inverse powers of that square root in the action. So these are gamma factors in the usual sense of relativistic dynamics. And so, you know, the three-point function has a gamma to the fifth in it, the two-point interactions have a gamma cubed in them. And so the ratio, the non-Gaussianity, is basically measured by this ratio of the three to two-point functions, scales like gamma squared. And our speed limit says that the velocity can't get larger than one, but it can get larger and larger. So gamma is fairly large in these models. And as a result of that, you find that when you go and calculate the full three-point function and get your prediction, it is necessarily non-Gaussian. It's viable still. I mean, it'll be constrained. The entire parameter space will basically be constrained by the Planck satellite and has been analyzed and constrained but not ruled out by both the WMAP-5 and WMAP-3 papers and by the Harvard group. But the neat thing is, it's falsifiable. It's honestly falsifiable. This mechanism necessarily produces a non-Gaussian signature, and if you don't see it, the model is definitely dead. So, of course, falsifiable may still mean that it's false, but at least it's exciting to be able to make some clean predictions. This idea that you can use self-interactions of the scalar field to slow it down is clearly, presumably, much more general than this specific form of the action that I described. You can, in general, expect these corrections, these higher dimension operator that I described before, to come not just with inverse powers of some hard mass scale M star in the effective action, but to come really also with inverse powers of the scalar fields phi, the scalar field phi itself, because that'll determine the masses of other fields. And this is how it works in this dBi model, but it's obviously a much more general point. And so however it came about, it would be really spectacular to see such a signal, and it is something that people look for in the data. And you can later, it was developed further to just describe phenomenologically all the possible shapes that you can get, assuming a single field, but not making any other real assumptions. And so we're ready for the data on this quantity as well. The shapes, it's fun to plot them, to visualize how different types of mechanisms for non-Gaussianity can be. So this is from Babich, Camilli, and Zaldarriaga's original paper on the different shapes, and the top plot is the DBI example, which is peaked at the equilateral shape. So these axes are basically the ratios of the momenta in that three-point function. And slow roll inflation is tiny in amplitude, in its shape, for what it's worth, would also be very different. It's peaked here, as is multiple field but slow roll inflation. So there's also, again, if you just look systematically at inflationary models, you can prove a theorem that if you saw a large amplitude in this shape, it cannot be a single field model, period. So if you look for a three-point function which is peaked in the squeeze configuration where two of the legs are long and one is short, you've discovered a new particle in inflation. So it's an extremely interesting observable. And even if, as might well happen, we just constrain it rather than observing it, we have cut out, you know, clean classes of inflationary models, and that's interesting and useful. So as far as I understand it, the observational situation is summarized as follows. The Planck satellite, which is going to launch this year, hopefully, will basically constrain the tilt to within something like 0.01, and won't do that well on the tensor to scalar ratio, but will cover most of the parameter space, if not all of it, for these in terms of the non-Gaussianity. And then there are these ground-based polarization experiments that I mentioned that will get delta R to order 0.01. And these things will really distinguish wildly different mechanisms for inflation. Small field inflation models, large field inflation models like this monodromy effect I described, models with these higher derivative terms like DBI, and multiple field models, all these things will be distinguished by this data, but it hasn't yet happened. And just to return to the overarching theme in case I've lost the forest for the trees, I think it's a really interesting direction, basically, again, because of this combination of genuine UV sensitivity from the theoretical point of view and, you know, the observational accessibility of some of these key numbers. So let me just therefore conclude, summarize. There's observational evidence for inflation that's well known, but basically just, you know, substantiates the overall framework of inflation without pinning down the mechanism very well at all yet. There are lots of interesting and different mechanisms for inflation that require a top-down or UV complete description to really formulate. And within string theory, it's been, I would say, surprisingly fruitful in that regard. I should say, when we found these mechanisms that led to predictions, they were not, you know, we were not working so as to engineer such a signal. We were just looking at how inflation might come out once we had stabilized these compactifications. And out popped these possibilities. Yesterday we heard about cosmic strings, and today these signatures in the CMB, by which, you know, we can really test these models. So let me just stop there. Yeah. I did. It's a great question. So it does have that feature. So let me just explain Michael's question a little bit more. So so we use this. So we have this torus, which is defined by some identifications with a vector tau in the complex plane. And in the Snell manifold, we basically identified after changing the shape of the torus from tau to tau plus some integer. But in general, you get the same torus if you have a change in the torus of this form with some integers here that satisfy some conditions. And what happens is, rather than changing shape in the way I drew, what happens in this Sol case, this more general case, is that it changes to, in a way such that it kind of shrinks in one direction and expands in another direction, but it's still the same torus as you move you know, some appropriate amount in this direction, and you can make a compact space in a similar way. So long story short, we did analyze that case in this same spirit. And the statement, so I alluded to all of these self-consistency conditions that we need to impose to get a good model. And I really should emphasize that. It's not just the geometry, it's the fact that the energy carried by this brain must not overwhelm the potential energy that we use to stabilize the compactification in the first place. So what happens in the Saul manifold case is that if you work it out, first of all, it would lead to a candidate model which is m squared phi squared, not phi to the 2/3. Well, that's fine. But the problem was that it was greater than the potential barriers stabilizing the moduli. And so one thing you could do is consider a stabilization mechanism that has a hot. So this is the curvature. So I should tell you also that the moduli stabilizing potential is related to the negative curvature scalar of the space. And so if you stabilize the moduli in a way where you use this curvature energy as one of the leading contributions, then you can, you know, then there's a clear comparison to do. And the Saul manifold fails, the Knill manifold works. You know, so this is a nice example of how you can't just do anything you want. There is, you know, we're now in the process of trying to check this far more generally. But another thing you can do, though, is ask if there are higher scale moduli fixing mechanisms. And, you know, unfortunately, there are. In fact, the original mechanism for stabilizing moduli used more than just this curvature energy. But in the same arena, there's a clean distinction. Well, I've been meaning to learn more about that, but the plots I've seen when I've, you know, listened to talks on this seem to not quite get down to inflation. And when they plot inflation, they tend to plot some unrealistically high value for this tensor to scalar ratio, even when they get, and even then they don't really get very close to it. But I'm not an expert on gravity wave detection. When it comes to non-Gaussianity, there is another method that people have started to look at, actually partly inspired by these models, because one thing that occurs in them is that the non-linearity, which is a intrinsic feature of this mechanism, say the DBI mechanism, tends to grow in time, it tends to change in time. So it becomes a larger effect, it can, depending on the direction, it can become a larger effect outside the CMB window. So you can look for it in clusters, and there are papers about how well you can do looking for the running non-Gaussianity from DBI inflation in clusters. Okay, so I've started to talk to our CIPAC cluster people about this, and I don't think it's competitive yet with CMB, but it's an interesting idea for an independent measurement. It's like Steve Allen's group is thinking about. Oh, okay. Well, like I said, I'd love to hear more about that, and I'm not an expert on it. That would be fantastic. Right. Oh, well, you know, of course, you can write down this effective action with those dimension six operators just included. But if you wrote down a generic effective theory, if you took, you know, Wilsonian point of view and didn't tune any couplings, it wouldn't work generically. You have to put small coefficients in front of the dimension six operators. And it's in that limited, but I think significant sense that I'm saying that you need a reason for that. And so that's true in any inflation model. And then another point was that for these cases where you phenomenologically get a gravity wave signature and have a high scale of inflation, for very simple reasons, which I could explain if you're interested, that correlates with having a field range that has to go over larger than a Planck distance in field space. And once you have that, you can see that it's much more UV sensitive, because you have to, it's not just one dimension six operator that you have to control, it's basically this whole function over that range. And so what we're excited about with this silly little monodromy mechanism is that, although you would have thought if you knew nothing else, you'd say, okay, that's maybe impossible, maybe that's just not going to happen, you'll encounter so new effects every Planck scale by at least, but here, you know, the theory just popped out this sense in which, no, you don't. And it, not only that, but then it's predictive. So, yeah, you're not going to get fight of the teeth. You're not going to get any particular power from Wilsonian analysis. So it goes over. We have to. By the way, I don't want to. There is fine tuning in this model of about the percent level that you'd expect, and putting that in. You get the, you basically need 9 Planck units of field space. Is that what you're asking? 9? No. Just a factor of 9. It's just 9. I mean, delta phi is 9 m Planck. Is that what you were asking? Yeah.
In units,
okay. So let me try and answer this better. So it doesn't go on forever, first of all, because a definite limiting feature is the moduli fixing potential. Okay, so what I'm drawing here is, this is my V of phi, which, by the way, near the origin, it's totally analytic. Near the origin, it's phi squared. But out in this super Planckian but finite region, it's phi to the 2/3. But eventually, it hits the scale, because the energy keeps increasing. It hits the scale of the moduli fixing potential, which is fixed. And so the model just doesn't exist after that point. After that point, it, you know, this manifold decompactifies or something. Happen. So it's not an infinite range, but there's a clean window where you can get what you need, and we just tune it minimally to obtain that, where this, you know, extends over 9 Planck units. Now, there are corrections to this, of course, so analyze those corrections systematically. For example, the full potential includes both the inflationary potential, which depends also on the moduli, and the moduli potential. So the inflation potential pushes on the moduli, and that back reacts on the inflaton at some level. And so we estimate all these things. We estimate corrections that come from the curvature of the ambient space, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, again, like I said, that's most of the paper, is analyzing these corrections and showing that they're small. And the best I can do of reason for that is that we enforce most of it by symmetry, by homogeneity of all the ingredients in the construction along this direction. And that is something that you can understand in effective field theory. The thing that breaks the symmetry is this potential itself and nothing else. And so then it's similar, actually, to Andre's old argument about approximate shift symmetries. Another thing I should say, since we're on this topic, is this is a very new construction, and we did not include, you know, a construction of the standard model as well, and that's that is something that should be done in this kind of inflationary model building, because you have to reheat into it and so on and so forth, and that could, well, it is a de Sitter stabilized model, but it's certainly, you certainly can't explicitly model the 10 to the minus 120 in any construction, so that's true. Well, I was just giving you the basic geometric idea. What we did is, you do have to choose the dimension. We chose 10. It's a common choice. And then we took a product of two of these nil three manifolds I wrote down, and there's some orientifold actions. You know, there's a lot more in the construction. But yeah, that's. They're not on the same footing. It's these nil manifolds are homogeneous but not isotropic. So the dimensions, even in a single one, they're not on the same footing. You have this one direction in which the thing changes shape. But But it's, again, I think it's sort of the next simplest manifold to a torus. I mean, I don't know if Michael would agree with that, but it's sure.
Thank you.